People often say to me, come on, part of you has got to want Trump to win because he gives you so much material to work with. No, no. No one tells the guy who cleans the bathroom, wow, you must love it when someone has explosive diarrhea. There's so much material for you to work with.
Oh, I feel you. I feel you, Mr. Colbert.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. Down the stairs, clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ. Down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ. Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ. In Seattle on KODX, Richmond, Virginia's WRWK. Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets on the Progressive Voices Channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining me today. Coming up, as climate advocates from nations around the world are gathering this week in Baku, Azerbaijan. I say that right, Desi? Baku?
Yes, you did. Good job.
For the 29th annual UN Climate Summit, the dread of a second Donald Trump term and what he will do to roll back gains for renewable energy and the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions as global heating intensifies. Well, that is reportedly the talk of the conference as it gets underway for some reason.
As one would expect.
There are, meanwhile, calls for Joe Biden to lock in some of the gains in advance of Trump 2.0. But what exactly can he do, and what, frankly, should he do? And what can all the rest of us do to both lock in gains and hold the line and hold off the promised destruction of our global environment under the next administration? We will be joined momentarily by an expert on all of these issues to try and figure it all out. But let's start with at least one piece of encouraging news today.
Oh, yes, please.
Before we get to the explosive diarrhea. Arizona's Democratic Congressman Ruben Gallego has been called the unofficial winner of the U.S. Senate seat that's being vacated by former Democrat, now independent Senator Kyrsten Sinema. Reportedly, he defeated Trump-endorsed election denier Carrie Lake, whose record streak in losing statewide elections for Arizona Republicans continues unabated.
She's number one.
That after her loss back in 2022 in the gubernatorial contest to Democrat Katie Hobbs. That leaves the current Senate balance next year, as far as we know, with 52 Republicans to 47 Democrats, with one remaining uncalled race still in Pennsylvania, where Republican hedge fund CEO Dave McCormick currently leads the three-term Democratic Senator Bob Casey by just under 30,000 votes out of nearly 7 million cast. That race has tightened since yesterday when we reported a 40,000 vote lead for McCormick. With the margin now less than one half of 1%, that race is likely to headed to a recount in the days ahead. And thus ends the fun news today. By and large, as there are still about 16 House races, still U.S. House races that are still uncalled by media outlets, with Democrats leading in 8, Republicans leading in 8. That said, the Republicans at this point only need to win, I think it's 2 of them, in order to take the majority next year. Some outlets have already suggested that Republicans will do exactly that, and that they will have a majority in the lower chamber next year, even if a narrower one than they had since 2022, when they couldn't do much of anything. If so, if they end up, if they can all agree with each other on stuff in the House, they haven't been very good at that over the past 2 years, that would be trifecta control of government next year for Republicans as Donald Trump takes office again. But it ain't over until every vote is tallied, so we will see. Speaking of Trump's next term, his team has announced a bunch of planned appointments over the past 24 hours since apparently they don't celebrate Veterans Day over there for some reason, so they had plenty of time to do this. Florida Congressman Mike Waltz, a former Green Beret and China Hawk, he will be named as Trump's new national security advisor. The first one from his previous term, General Michael Flynn, you may recall, left the job after about a week or so after it turned out he was an undeclared asset working for Turkey and meeting in secret with Russia. Florida's U.S. Senator Marco Rubio, a policy hawk on China and Iran, and a man who used to be derided by Trump as Lil Marco, until Lil Marco and ultimately ended up kissing Big Donnie's ring, he is to be named as Secretary of State. We'll see how long he lasts in that role. The popular Twitter account named Angry Staffer noted earlier today, quote, Marco Rubio, Trump's Secretary of State pick, explicitly said yesterday that he would not call for a ceasefire in Gaza. Adding a great job to all the protest voters who snubbed Harris over Israel. You guys are really playing 6D chess here. Puppy killer and South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, who has reportedly been selected by Trump to lead his Department of Homeland Security. if she sets up her office in a gravel pit, well, I would not take a meeting with her, frankly. And perhaps the most disturbing appointment to date, frankly, Donald Trump announced late Sunday that Tom Homan, his former acting director of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, that would be ICE, who backed his controversial family separation policy the first time and was the acting director of ICE because he could not win Senate confirmation during Trump's first term, well, he will be the new administration's so-called border czar, which is a made-up position that doesn't really exist and has no official powers, but in a lawless Trump administration where Trump has already instructed the U.S. Senate to recess as soon as possible after he is sworn in so that he can avoid the Constitution's mandate for advice and consent by the U.S. Senate for presidential appointees, by using recess appointments to staff up his cabinet. Well, in that world, this guy, Tom Homan, will have a lot of power, specifically to direct mass deportations. Homan touts hardline immigration views. He previously vowed to, quote, run the biggest deportation force this country has ever seen. He was an early supporter of the original Trump administration's zero tolerance policy, which led to thousands of families being separated, children essentially kidnapped from their parents at the southern border. He was a contributor, by the way, to Heritage Foundation's Project 2025, you know, the one that Donald Trump claimed he wanted nothing to do with during the campaign. He's also the president and CEO of Border 911, a nonprofit that warns of the supposed threat posed by undocumented immigrants who want to come over and help pick our food to feed the nation. During the campaign, Trump said that he wanted to deport as many as 20 million of those undocumented immigrants as part of the largest mass deportation that the country has ever seen, in Trump's words. In an interview with CBS 60 Minutes just last month, Tom Homan was asked about whether there was a way to carry out mass deportations without separating families. Here's how that went, including his chilling answer to that question.
We have seen one estimate that says it would cost $88 billion to deport a million people a year.
I don't know if that's accurate or not.
Is that what American taxpayers should expect?
What price do you put on national security? Is that worth it?
Is there a way to carry out mass deportation without separating families?
Of course there is. Families can be deported together.
Families can be deported together, whether they are citizens or not.
Yep.
So I hope America, including MAGA, is buckled up for what is likely to happen beginning on January 20th, particularly under the command of that thug. Trump ally and former New York Congressman Lee Zeldin has been announced as the new head of the Environmental Protection Agency, despite his record in Congress of voting against environmental protections.
Or perhaps because of it.
Yeah, there you go. We'll have more on that in our upcoming Green News Report later this hour. I'll also ask my guest about that appointment as well. But in the meantime, as the New York Times reports, as Donald J. Trump's transition team plans his energy and environment agenda, it is relying on two former cabinet leaders and fossil fuel lobbyists to dramatically reshape the agency's charge with protecting the nation's air, water, climate, and public lands. The task is familiar to David Bernhardt, a former oil lobbyist who headed the Interior Department in the Trump administration, the first one, and Andrew Wheeler, a former coal lobbyist who ran the Environmental Protection Agency. Both are Washington insiders with years of experience in dismantling federal environmental protections. People working on the transition have already prepared a slate of executive orders and presidential proclamations on climate and energy, including withdrawing the U.S. from the Paris Climate Agreement, eliminating every office in every agency working to end the pollution that disproportionately affects poor communities, and shrinking the size of national monuments in the West to allow more drilling and mining on public lands. Remember when our mainstream corporate media warned you over and over about all of that before Election Day? Yeah, me neither. Although we did several times. We tried. President Biden has made environmental justice a top priority and has sought to ensure that underserved communities benefit from at least 40% of clean energy development. That initiative will be scrapped, people with the plan said, as part of a greater effort to dismantle what Mr. Trump's allies view as the woke agenda. So again, all of those minority folks who voted for Donald Trump, I hope they're happy with this, with what's coming their way. Trump is also expected to move swiftly to end the Biden administration's pause on permitting new liquid natural gas export terminals and to revoke a longstanding waiver that allows California and other states to set tighter pollution standards than the federal government. So much for states' rights that Republicans pretend to care about, you know, unless it's inconvenient to them and to their fossil fuel industry funders. Mr. Trump also intends to install an energy czar. Yep, I'm old enough, by the way, to remember when they used to pretend that such czars were unconstitutional.
And smack to the Soviet Union.
There'll be an energy czar to coordinate policies across agencies in an effort to cut regulations and make it easier to ramp up the production of oil, gas, and coal, despite the fact that the U.S. is already producing a record amount of energy. Moreover, some people on the transition team are discussing moving the EPA headquarters and its 7,000 workers out of Washington, D.C., because, of course, if they do that, they know that thousands of workers will simply opt not to move because, you know, they've got lives and families and houses in D.C. and spouses who work there, children who go to school there. so they can't just get up and, move to Omaha or wherever they're talking about.
It will also make the EPA's work much, much more expensive because most of it needs to be in the District of Columbia.
And they'll just end up killing the EPA by attrition that way.
Yeah.
Because they won't hire people to take their places. As Trump said in a video on his campaign website, quote, "Just as I move the Bureau of Land Management to Colorado, as many as 100,000 government positions could be moved out, and I mean immediately, out of Washington." So did you know about that? Because we tried to tell you. Don't know how many others in the media did. Apparently, it wasn't enough. The energy czar job description is reminiscent of the White House Energy Task Force that was overseen by Vice President Dick Cheney during the George W. Bush administration, aimed at ensuring that fossil fuels would remain the U.S. primary energy resource for, quote, years down the road. The EPA transition team includes Mr. Wheeler, who during Trump's first term as his EPA head, dismantled rules to cut fossil fuel pollution from power plants and automobiles and oil and gas wells, ensuring that billions of tons of planet-warming carbon dioxide emissions would continue to heat the atmosphere. Now, the Biden administration restored and expanded those rules, but, well, you know what's going to happen to them probably beginning around noon on January 20th of next year. Jean Sue, the director of the Energy Justice Program and a senior attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity, will join us next to discuss all of that and how and if Joe Biden can take action right now to prevent at least some of this, and if climate advocates can possibly hold the line for the climate, for the planet, for humanity during a second Trump term. That is next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. Please drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Working on it. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com trying to hold the line. According to Inside Climate News this week, Donald Trump has promised to demolish the country's domestic and international climate policies at a crucial moment when climate scientists say the window is closing on the world's ability to avoid the most dangerous impacts of global warming. But in the 8 years since Trump's shocking 2016 win, environmental groups have built more organized, collaborative coalitions and say that they won't be caught off guard by Trump's second term in the White House. Well, that's good. Quote, "This is much less of a surprise than it was last time," said Jonathan Pershing, the former special envoy for climate under the Obama administration. He helped oversee the transition to the first Trump administration. He said, quote, "It's not been a question of the kind of shock that the system collectively saw when it was expected that Hillary Clinton would win. The consequences of that," Pershing added, "is that there's been a great deal of planning, a great deal of scenario work, a great deal of thinking on how to reflect on the last time this happened. Despite the challenges posed by a clearly anti-climate action administration, the groups have some momentum behind them and say that they plan to strategically capitalize on it. The world's seemingly inexorable transition away from fossil fuels will continue with or without the Trump White House," they say. The Biden administration's Inflation Reduction Act, the biggest ever investment in climate action, has already dispersed billions in tax credits and subsidies to clean energy programs, cities and states, the majority of them, by the way, led by Republicans who could be skittish about rescinding any of those funds. Finally, and perhaps most crucially, the country will see a swell of young voters in coming elections who, regardless of party affiliation, have felt the impacts of climate change-fueled disasters and understand the realities of global warming. Quote, we know the climate crisis under the Trump administration could be accelerated, could be, said Christina Ramirez, president of Next Gen America, a youth advocacy group. She says, we are determined to do everything possible to stop that from happening, to make sure that the incredible gains under the Inflation Reduction Act will be defended. We're not going to let progress be rolled back without an absolute fight, she said. This week, many of the country's major environmental and climate advocacy groups held calls with reporters, voicing their resolve, outlining specific plans, and perhaps giving themselves a public-facing pep talk. Quote, we're ready. We have a plan to fight against any and all efforts to harm public health, climate action, and the environment, said Manish Bapna, the president of the National Resources Defense Council, in a call with reporters this last week. We're going to use every lever we have to defend people and nature. Well, that optimistic public face is good. Less publicly, however, some of the folks have been not quite as confident about the future. Let's be honest, we can't sugarcoat it. We're deeply disappointed in the results, said Gene Karpinski, president of the League of Conservation Voters. It's very clear that the big polluters will have friends at the White House again. The fossil fuel industry is already at it, said Ben Jealous, executive director of Sierra Club. This is the enemy that we are fighting. One analysis by the group Carbon Brief found that Trump's plans to roll back Biden climate policies could wipe out the greenhouse gas reductions of the last 5 years of clean energy growth worldwide twice over. The groups acknowledge that a second Trump administration is also going to be better organized as well and will have learned from its own mistakes, particularly in its legal challenges of climate and environmental laws, the majority of which were overturned in the courts because of Trump administration missteps. Trump has appointed three of the sitting U.S. Supreme Court justices, making that body more hostile to upholding environmental protections or laws that undergird climate regulations. Quote, we are going to play defense at the federal level, Karpinski said. We're going to have to do it better this time. One of the groups vowing to do it better this time is the Center for Biological Diversity, the well-respected national nonprofit conservation organization with more than 1.7 million members and online activists. Following the election of Donald Trump to a second term as president, the Center released a statement vowing, quote, an all-out effort to protect the climate, wildlife, and wild places from Trump's destructive environmental policies. Trump 2.0, according to the group's executive director, Kieran Suckling, is going to get twice the fight from the protectors of our planet, wildlife, and basic human rights. We've battled Trump from the border wall to the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, and in many cases, we've won, he said, adding, this country's bedrock environmental laws stand strong, and we're more prepared than ever to block the disastrous Trump policies we know are coming. For example, they vow that the center will resist Trump's plan to, quote, drill, 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 and his efforts to fulfill promises to the oil industry to reverse dozens of federal measures that protect public lands, imperiled wildlife, and human health. Said Suckling, quote, it's going to take a few more rounds in the ring, but we are confident that Trump's greed, bigotry, misogyny, his anti-democratic zealotry, all will be defeated. Well, that is optimistic, but I do welcome the hope at this point. With Trump set to take office in a few short months, the group says the center is calling on the Biden administration to safeguard as many environmental protections as possible in the coming weeks. Joining us now is Gene Hsu, director of the Center for Biological Diversity's Energy Justice Program, dedicated to hastening the clean, small-d democratic energy future so urgently needed to protect wildlife, communities, and the climate. Gene Hsu, thank you for joining us on the broadcast today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Good to have you here. I wish it was under better circumstances, but I'm glad to know you guys are there for this fight. Listen, as environmental advocates are gathering this week in Baku, Azerbaijan, for the latest UN climate summit, the so-called COP29, the 29th annual conference of parties, it seems that much of the conversation there so far predictably has to do with Trump's election. Before we get to that, however, and what your group is calling for and hoping to do, we've spent a lot of time on this program and on our Green News Report feature, sort of lauding the landmark achievements on climate and environment by the Biden administration. One part of, you know, authoritarian takeovers is sort of to diminish the accomplishments of the predecessors. So before that predictable effort gets underway in Trump 2, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the Biden-Harris climate legacy before the new winners sort of try to rewrite history.
So it's a bit of a more complicated take than I think, you know, has been said so far. Mm-hmm. And I'll break it down like this. You know, the Biden administration came out rearing with kind of pretty straightforward climate commitments. We had an administration that cares about climate. That was a total 180 from the previous Trump administration, who denied it completely. So, you know, we had rhetoric that was out there saying that they were committed to it. Mm-hmm. I think what we've seen over the past 4 years from the Biden administration is a far more complex story and relationship with climate. And a part of that is because they embraced both clean energy, mm-hmm. as well as, unfortunately, dirty energy. Mm-hmm. And they took that as an all of the above approach. So, you know, over the past 4 years, yes, we can absolutely applaud the Biden administration for passing the Inflation Reduction Act, clean energy credits. Those are something that have been infused into the economy. They are building jobs. They are building and manufacturing solar panels to heat pumps. Those are things that have been good for the economy and for the climate. But on the other hand, we have to actually face the mirror of what the Biden administration also did during those 4 years. Mm-hmm. And that is actually reaching record production of oil and gas. Mm-hmm. They approved the devastating Willow Project in Alaska, the nation's largest oil drilling operation. The Inflation Reduction Act itself actually had oil and gas giveaways. Mm-hmm. So it's a complex relationship, and one that, you know, we'll be seeing over time how that actually plays out. What is going to be happening with the Trump administration is that it is a total unfettered giveaway to oil and gas. He does not care about clean energy. He does not care about the communities at all in any of the places that fossil fuels are being produced and shipped. And that's going to be the big change that we're going to see. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned it before, you know, what this new administration is going to do. And I'll be really honest and, you know, dark. I mean, it's just truthfully, yeah, a dark moment at this time in terms of our federal work. We are basically facing a trifecta of, you know, monopolization of all three branches of government under a climate denying fascist. We have our executive branch taken over by a climate denier fascist in chief, Donald Trump. He has vowed to drill, baby drill, as you said, with mm-hmm. no relief for any clean energy or any care for climate. And he will strip the Environmental Protection Agency, as you said. He will strip the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice. We will have an entire administrative apparatus be entirely smothered, stripped bare, and not functional in any way in terms of actually protecting our environment and our health and safety. We have a Congress that is on the cusp of losing the House. And so we have a Senate and House that will be unable to move anything offensively good on climate climate forward. And finally, as you said, we also have a very dangerous Supreme Court situation where he has also vowed to replace Justices Alito and Thomas with far younger right-wing judges. Yeah. And that means that our judiciary, our third branch of government, which has always, you know, time immemorial, stood out as the branch to check abuse of power, is also under siege. So the federal work of challenging oil and gas executives, the people who will benefit most from a Trump administration, is really greatly at threat. I think in the past we've all had in Trump 2.0 era or in Trump 1.0 era, the idea that we are going to fight, we are going to resist. We did much of that work through the judiciary. And unfortunately now things have changed a bit where the judiciary just is not going to necessarily hold that line for us.
Yeah, it was interesting in reading that piece from Inside Climate News, all of the sort of climate activists who sort of saying, well, we've done this before. We fought this fight before. We know how to do it. We can do it again. We're going to do it even harder and better this time, putting on an optimistic face. But it does seem like, you know, what you guys have to do here, what we all have to do here, is somewhat limited in the face of what we are looking at. Now, in your group's press release today, I think, from Baku, your colleague at the center, Ben Goloff, is quoted as saying, quote, climate diplomacy on a boiling planet does not stop for a climate denier. Before Trump takes office, Biden officials need to use the next 2 months to set up a bulwark of protections and secure their climate legacy. Okay, I'll bite. Sounds great. But what exactly are these actions that the Biden administration could take before the end of the term to advance these important environment and climate goals that can't then be immediately turned back by the next administration?
Yeah, so there are several things that the Biden administration can do, which is good. Let's take the global front first, which is where I should be there, but I'm 7 months pregnant, so unfortunately, I'm unable to be there.
Oh.
But I've been fighting on that front for a decade now. Uh-huh. So on the global front, the Biden administration has a couple of arrows in their quiver. The first is that they still have the ability to put out a pretty ambitious commitment to the world of how they are going to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways that we've been, you know, really fighting for them to do that is to phase out our fossil fuel production. The U.S. is the largest oil and gas producer in the world. By setting that type of commitment, which they can submit before they leave, is actually putting out a blueprint of what the United States can do in these next intervening years. And a big part of that is what states can do. And I think putting out that national plan, it is a plan, will give states, especially states that are at the heart of oil and gas country, methods and ways to phase out and to fight for it. So that is a soft thing to do, but it's important for the Biden administration to do that.
And is that, let me jump in for a second. They make those commitments at COP29 and they, you know, lay out what states and so forth can do, even if the federal level may not do what we hope they will do. Isn't that something that the Trump administration has already said they're going to get out of the Paris Agreement? Isn't that something that they can come in and say, yeah, we take that back. We rescind what it was that the Biden administration submitted to this group just, 2 months ago?
Yeah, so it is. We absolutely know that Trump will be pulling out of the Paris Agreement, mm-hmm. but what it signals is a global signal to other countries to not step back, to keep going, and an internal bat signal for everyone on the ground in the U.S. to keep going. And I think there's that type of leadership that needs to be signaled. I will say what's really important about the Paris Agreement and the United States pulling out is that the U.S. has monopolized in many ways a leadership position on the global stage for climate. And in that as well, over the last few years, they've been able to make increasingly important commitments under the Biden administration. So last year, for example, for the first time in over 30 years of climate negotiations, the world promised to transition off of fossil fuels. And that was, in a lot of ways, shepherded by the United States. Mm-hmm. With the U.S. stepping out, this puts others in a position, in particular the EU, into a leadership position that they should absolutely take and run with. Climate change is a global problem. It is not a U.S. problem, even though the U.S. is the number one culprit. But it is a global problem, and we need global leadership. We need other countries to step up and lead, and they have to continue without the United States. And that's what we are looking towards.
In your press release from Baku, Azerbaijan today, you also quote Jamie Minden. He's the executive director at Zero Hour. He argues, quote, before Trump takes office, President Joe Biden must reject all pending LNG, liquid natural gas, export permits, and stop the expansion of fossil fuel. He adds, quote, our climate is on the brink of collapse, and it's sheer madness that politicians continue to expand and subsidize deadly fossil fuels. You mentioned this a bit, Jean Hsu, earlier. The Biden administration seemed to spend more political capital on expanding renewable energy rather than halting the expansion of fossil fuels. In fact, they, while they place some restrictions on public lands and so forth, fossil fuel development actually expanded under Biden-Harris. So,
yes, it did.
Two-part question here. A, was that a mistake since it actually didn't get them reelected anyway? And B, what could possibly be done now at the end of the administration that would immediately be, that wouldn't be immediately reversed by the incoming Trump administration, even if, Joe Biden went out and announced tomorrow there shall be no more fossil fuels in America, as Zero Hour is calling for. It seems like that's, again, rhetoric that would just be simply reversed by the next administration.
So there is a lot of contradiction in what the Biden administration did. We have led the four-year campaign asking the Biden administration to declare a climate emergency to phase out fossil fuels. That mm-hmm. that has been our number one ask for them. I think in many parts, inflation backdoor pressure from oil and gas corporations have been a big part of why they have kept drilling and wanting to ease people's minds about the price at the pump. So these are all complex factors of what's going on. But the truth of the matter is that the Biden administration still has the ability to stop and pause LNG exports going out the door before mm-hmm. they leave office. Mm-hmm. We are asking the Biden administration, they've lost the vote. They've lost the next term. Right. So please do something on fossil fuels and shut down CP2, which is a large, which will be the largest LNG export terminal, as well as the Dakota Access Pipeline, which everyone knows is a disastrous poisoning project of an oil pipeline running across Middle America. So these are steps that they can absolutely take. It's within their executive authority to do it. And we're asking them to make that change before they leave. Now, what happens after? So let's say they do it. They absolutely have the ability to do it legally. Mm-hmm. So if they do it, it will take Trump a little bit of time to undo it because he can, it's based on different tests, essentially tests for public interest. And it will be, very, very much litigated. And this is where, again, lawyers come in terms of process. We can actually litigate, challenge, and stave off those exports and that oil transport for a good bit of time, potentially years. So this is where, asks for something positive on fossil fuels may be able to help us delay the actual disastrous impacts of exports and oil transport for a good little while.
Is that the key at this point? And I should note, aside from being a climate champion and an expectant mother, I believe you're also an attorney. Is that how the Center for Biological Diversity and these other groups that you've been speaking with will be able to push back against the Trump administration and their anti-environment agenda? Essentially, it's in court. It's a legal battle at this point.
I think the legal part is how we've done it in the past. And I'll say this, everyone that you mentioned just now, mm-hmm. have all talked about 1.0, Trump era 1.0, mm-hmm. and this idea of resistance. We're going to resist. Well, how do you best resist? You can best resist through bringing lawsuits and jacking up the process and basically delay until something politically different can move. And that's where I think the second part of this is so important. Everybody has been dissecting why we lost this election. So many theories, so many fingers pointed at different people. And I think one of the main takeaways of all of this is simply the status quo. Nobody likes it. And not enough people wanted to vote for a status quo Democratic candidate. That means that resistance, this idea of resistance, uh-huh. resistance is essentially defending the status quo. These ideas of resisting Donald Trump are about defending against his rollbacks, mm-hmm. And fighting even worse things like the border wall. That is fine. So at the same time as we're doing those resistance movements, mostly focused on litigation, our offense also needs to be incredible. And when I say that, that takes a whole different other set of skills to get us out of our status quo. And this is where we can actually make offensive moves on climate. What all of this has told us from a climate movement perspective is that we've been pretty siloed in the ways that we do things. Mm. We are at a moment where we have an incoming president who is going to be attacking working families, migrant families, women, LGBTQ folks, including and most especially transgender people. All of these people have targets on their back. And this gives us an unprecedented organizing opportunity to bring people together and create a political system that trumps the status quo and is actually responsive to what people need. It's a political movement. We have 4 years to do it. And we need to do that if we're going to get anywhere on this scale of fighting for justice. Mm. Status quo stuff will not work. And that's exactly the key message of this election coming through.
I might suggest we've got 2 years to do it before the next election, which can make a big difference.
Absolutely.
As far as what the Trump administration can do in their second 2 years in office. Jean Hsu, very quickly, I've got two more points I want to hit with you. Just very quickly, it was announced on Monday that former New York Republican Congressman Lee Zeldin, with a long record of voting in Congress against environmental protections, he'll head up he's been named in any event to head up Trump's EPA. Your response to Zeldin's appointment quickly.
It's an abomination and we will resist.
Good answer. I like it. Finally, we will be talking about in our upcoming Green News Report today about successes around the country at the state level last week on ballot initiatives, even in so-called red states for climate and environmental issues. One of the few bright spots, I think, last week. But how important right now is it for states to sort of double their own aggressiveness in this regard? How much of that can be overturned at the federal level? And how do you explain the sort of divide between voters voting for climate initiatives on the ballot, like I say, even in these red states, while voting for anti-climate candidates on the very same ballot?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think there are a ton of surveys going into this right now. The bright spot in all of this, or the place where we are going to see any movement on climate and really any of those other issues that I just spoke about, it are at the state level. State initiatives, if they do not interfere with federal law, will be able to go through. And I think, you know, what we've been hearing from different people on the ground is that the initiatives that are happening at the state level are things that people can feel. They are able to see how some climate initiatives will generate the jobs that they need in their own backyard. So it becomes much more real instead of rhetoric from presidents on a national level. It feels much farther away. And I think that gives us a bright spot of actual work to be done. One of the areas that I work a lot in is a huge battleground area at the state level where electricity decisions are made on a day-to-day basis. And those are at the public utility commissions. Now, that is an incredibly Byzantine system of government. It's regulations of monopoly utilities. And we've been able to witness over the past few years how those monopoly utilities are stifling rooftop and community solar and just digging in with more fossil fuels. That is an area that is ripe for intervention and for organizing. And we're going to be looking at those types of opportunities, those more democratic elected PUCs, the public utility commissions, to get more work done. And I think those are the bright spots that we're going to see the most movement in climate.
Your work, groups like yours, groups like the Center for Biological Diversity, Jean Sue, are obviously going to be more important now, I fear, than ever. I don't fear, I actually hope, because we are 100% behind you and with you. Jean Sue is the director of the Energy Justice Program and a senior attorney at the Center for Biological Diversity. You can find their work, their important work, at biologicaldiversity.org. Or you can go on to the site still known as Twitter, where they are Center for BioDiv. And Jean Sue is there as well as A. Jean Sue. Jean, I'm sorry you couldn't be in Baku, but that is our gain here that we get to have you. Good luck with the baby coming up, and thank you so much for joining us. We may be bothering you soon after you get a short break for maternity.
Hope so.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. Thank you. Well, she pulls no punches, it seems to me.
This is true. You know, and I just want to follow up on one thing that she talked about. I know that it may sound like inserting wrenches into the machine, causing delays, you know, either legally or procedurally. That may not sound like much, but it actually does have an effect because it will give time for renewable energy projects to continue to surge and compete against fossil fuels because, you know, renewables are now cheaper than fossil fuels.
And hey, delay apparently works. It kept Donald Trump out of jail for the past 4 years.
Well, there
you go. Legal delay, I guess. I guess that's one of the ways we move forward here. All right, quick break, and we're back with more Desi Doyen and our latest Green News Report. That's straight ahead on the Bradcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Hey, this is Brad. The Bradcast survives thanks to you and your support. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate today to help us continue to do over your public airwaves what we try to do 5 days a week. That's bradblog.com/donate, and thank you. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Well, we were speaking with Jean Sue there. It looks like Donald Trump has announced his selection of John Ratcliffe, a fierce defender of his, as the New York Times reports it, who was the National Intelligence Director during Donald Trump's first term. He will now be leading the CIA under Donald Trump's second term. I want to say, well, it's better than Kash Patel, but I'm not sure if that's the case.
I think it is, but we'll find out.
We'll find out. I'll try to ask. I think is Marcy Wheeler hopefully going to join us on tomorrow's show?
Right. Yes, she is.
I'll ask her. I'll bet she's got an opinion about that.
You know she does.
Until then, let's get to it. Our latest Green News Report.
So day one and the first 100 days, we have the opportunity to roll back regulations.
Trump selects anti-environment former congressman to lead EPA. 2024 will be the hottest year on record, UN Weather Agency confirms. Plus,
Washington's Climate Commitment Act is staying.
State ballot measures were a bright spot for the climate in last week's otherwise grim election.
All of that grim news and more straight ahead from BradBlog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
If you're worried right now that Donald Trump is going to ruin America, I think your fears are misplaced because he actually might ruin the entire planet.
Feel better? This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I know you got a lot to get to, so have at it.
Well, first, the World Meteorological Organization announced on Monday that 2024 will be the hottest year ever recorded since record keeping began in the mid-1800s and breaking the record set just last year. The next round of UN climate treaty talks just got underway in Baku, Azerbaijan, with climate denier Donald Trump's election in the United States casting a shadow over the conference.
I bet it is.
Here in the U.S., President-elect Trump has selected former Republican Congressman Lee Zeldin to head the Environmental Protection Agency. In Congress, Zeldin voted against bills to replace the nation's lead water pipes and against funding for climate-resilient infrastructure and clean energy manufacturing.
Perfect choice for the Environmental Protection Agency.
If confirmed, Zeldin would lead the Republican effort to reverse President Biden's climate laws and policies, including repealing new rules, reducing air pollution and climate warming emissions from power plants and tailpipes, and plans to gut the agency itself.
MAGA is gonna love it.
But there was some good news for the climate and environment in the states in last week's elections. Inside Climate News reports, with ballot initiatives faring well. Arguably the biggest was in Washington State, where voters firmly rejected a measure to repeal the state's landmark climate law, an effort backed by the fossil fuel industry and Republican lawmakers. The wildly successful Climate Commitment Act created a market-based cap and invest system that allows the state to charge top polluters for their pollution to push them to decarbonize. The law has already generated billions of dollars in revenue for investments in climate resilience projects, transportation, clean air, renewable energy, conservation, emissions reduction, and more.
So voters voted to keep that in place.
Yes, they did.
Good.
In Honolulu, Hawaii, voters passed an initiative to create a climate resiliency fund fed by property tax revenue to ensure a reliable funding stream for upgrading infrastructure against climate impacts and to assist residents after climate disasters. In Louisiana, voters overwhelmingly approved a constitutional amendment that requires that any revenue received by the state from renewable energy production will go into Louisiana's Coastal Protection and Restoration Fund and keeping it out of the reach of state lawmakers.
Good.
In South Dakota, voters squarely rejected a measure that would have made it easier to construct pipelines carrying carbon dioxide. The measure would have blocked local government control and boosted the use of eminent domain to seize landowners' property. And finally, in California, voters solidly approved a $10 billion bond measure to increase funding for building climate resilience projects across the state to fortify against intensifying extreme weather disasters like historic drought, heat, floods, and catastrophic wildfires, and to help ensure that residents, particularly in frontline communities, have access to safe and reliable drinking water. Funds will go to upgrade water systems, restore groundwater supplies, and protect rivers and streams from toxic pollution. Also, wildfire prevention, extreme heat mitigation, conservation of wilderness and coastal areas, and climate-smart agriculture. According to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, investments created through climate resilience bond measures end up paying off in huge dividends over time. FEMA estimates that every $1 spent on climate preparedness saves $6 on avoided disaster relief and costs.
So voters, even in red states, keep voting for these progressive initiatives when it comes to the climate, even while they're voting for candidates who hate the environment and are trying to destroy it.
Exactly.
That makes sense. Maybe we got a problem with our media somehow here, don't you think?
Oh, definitely.
Not here on the Green News Report, however. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find, follow, and share us planet-wide on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site, yes, still known as Twitter, at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Upside down, I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I find.
We are just upside down, man. I really do not understand how voters can vote for, you know, progressive things to protect the environment, because they care about that stuff. And
yes,
yet
it polls extremely well.
And yet they go out and vote for candidates who are going to do the exact opposite of what they want. And then you got, you know, these third-party voters who say, well, that's okay. I don't care if a guy like Trump gets in, because it'll be so bad, people will see just, you know, how important it is to, I don't know. I don't even understand that thinking. But when I hear that now, it's like, yeah, that made sense 8 years ago when you did the same thing. And did anybody learn the lesson from it? Apparently not. Only this time it's going to be much, much worse.
Yes. And, you know, there's a good question about how that kind of resistance that Jean Hsu has been talking about. She spoke to how difficult it will be to try to fight back against these rollbacks in the courts, which have now been taken over by Trump appointees.
Oh, I didn't know they were going to take over the courts, too. Oh, now we're really screwed. I'm sorry I voted that way.
Well, you know, and I think a lot of people just do not have the information. They did not hear the information about what Trump has planned for them. And that's I think, where we are. And that is an issue that comes up in with the media the time.
It's weird. Every time I post Green News Report to Twitter, Elon Musk does not retweet it. I just don't understand why.
So anyway,
all right, yeah, got to get out anyway. We got to get out. Thank you to our producer. That is Desi Doyen. Thanks as well to my guest today, Jean Hsu of the Center for Biological Diversity, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It is always an honor and always appreciated. If you missed any portion of today's show or you want to share it with someone you know, love, or hate, you can do it anytime for free by going to bradblog.com, where we post every show going back to the beginning of time itself. You can also, while you're there, please consider hitting one of those donate buttons to help us stay on your public airwaves for as long as we can stand it and as long as you can stand it. We rely only on you to stay on the airwaves. And obviously right now, we need you more than ever. I know I keep saying that. And it's just true now more than ever.
Somebody's got to report this stuff.
Drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. And on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site still known as Twitter, I am the Brad Blog. Stop on by. Retweet me. I know that Elon Musk won't. All right. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
Things aren't always just what they seem. I wanna turn the whole thing upside down. I'll find the things they say just can't be found. I'll share this love I find with everyone. We'll sing and dance.